Good morning. It's Friday, the 11th of October. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. We begin with our current events discussion, the Roundtable panel. We have an amazing group joining us, and I will introduce them to you in just a moment. Later on in the program, after a lockbox break, we will have a special conversation with Moon Unit Zappa. Yes.
Wow.
The daughter of musical visionary Frank Zappa. She'll discuss her new book, Earth to Moon, a memoir, and growing up in the 70s of Los Angeles and the 80s of Hollywood as the Valley Girl. And she will be at the Golden Notebook in Woodstock on Sunday. She will be with us this morning. Also, housing in short supply in the Northeast. In today's Congressional Corner, Democratic Connecticut U.S. Senator Chris Murphy will wrap up his conversation in the Congressional Corner. We begin with our roundtable panel and meet the group this morning, and it's a darn impressive one. The Ulster County Comptroller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, is here. Good morning, March. How are you?
Good morning. Happy to be here. Had a really phenomenal experience last night watching the Northern Lights, and I think many listeners in your area did so as well. Yeah.
It was one of those things that, you know, they talk about things going viral, but within 2 minutes there were 500 photos on social media, and people were, your neighbors were saying, go outside right now. Go,
you get most documented event this week.
And it was really cool.
Yeah.
Very, very, very neat. You only usually see that in Photoshop. So that's cool. Corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan, is with us. Good morning, Rich. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm well. I don't know if you sold it to the audience, but you're good. That's great.
Did my morning workout at Metabolic, did the 5 a.m. I'm feeling good.
Excellent. I'm glad you're here and you made it through all of that, because that sounds very stressful. We welcome the mayor of this fine city and a dear friend to this program, and we are lucky to have her this morning, and whenever she comes, joins us. Kathy Sheehan, Albany mayor, good morning. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
I'm well.
Good.
How are things in the city this fine morning?
You know, we certainly have challenges. I'm still, as everybody is, I think, very troubled by the horrific news of the incident that occurred where an individual was attacked by dogs. And so, you know, it's just a reminder that, you know, I think about whether it's that type of tragedy or what my fellow mayors are experiencing down in Florida. You know, these can be challenging times, and it's sobering at times. So I think I'm sobered by it all this morning.
And you never know when you wake up. We were talking about this off air before you came in with you and your deputy chief of staff, but you never know what the day is going to bring. That's like okay, and yet, I mean, that's the job, and yet, you know, so much for planning lunch.
It's better than doing the same thing day after day. So the variety is the spice of life.
I don't know.
Thank you. There's that silver lining. Okay.
All right. I don't quite know how to take that. You know, you talk about the dog story, but how many, 8 or 9 dogs?
There were a number of adult dogs and then a pretty significant number of puppies that were found in the house.
And so now it's getting to the bottom of this and how it happens and what goes on, but not far from here.
That's right. I mean, it's a process that will have to take place, and it's an active investigation, so I can't say much more than that about it, but clearly just a horrific outcome. And, you know, as the former owner of a pit bull, we still miss our Odell. I think it's unfortunate that the breed gets the reputation that it does, that there are those who you can train virtually any animal to do terrible things. And so, you know, we don't know. We're still actively investigating, but it certainly appears that these dogs had been trained to fight. You know, we will. You know, that outcome will be determined. There may be the courts involved, but again, it's still a very active investigation.
One of my dearest friends has rescued 4 or 5 pit bulls out of the pits, and they are just the loveliest, most beautiful, incredible dogs that I've ever seen. And yeah, I mean, you to make them into what they become in that fighting sense. But they're just they are glorious animals when you give them their due. It's quite and the people who do that work are just walk on water as far as I'm concerned of getting them housed and out of those conditions. Good stuff. Let's go to what is the top story of the day, and that, of course, is what is happening in Florida. The storm, this is Hurricane Milton. The storm made landfall Wednesday evening, devastating an area still recovering from Hurricane Helene, which tore through Florida's western coast 2 weeks ago. I think probably most of us, except for you who are ultimate purists and just will not have a radio or a television, but maybe you've seen them in a newspaper. The images coming from that region are just startling and really horrible, as are, and then you put that along with what happened following Hurricane Helene in the state of North Carolina, and you have a lot of damage in the United States of America. Millions remain without power, and Florida begins recovery. The state's preparations probably limited the impact of the storm, one of the strongest to ever hit Florida. At least 12 deaths were tied to Hurricane Milton. And it is, the Coast Guard said authorities had reopened several commercial ports in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina after assessing each for safety following Milton's landfall. Several other ports in Florida remained closed on Thursday night, according to the Coast Guard. The big story, of course, power outages in Florida. They've dropped to about 2.6 million customers. That's down from 3.4 million earlier on Thursday, according to PowerOutage.us, which tracks data from utility companies. And the other thing, of course, is these are regions that have been hit. Some areas like Sanibel Island have been hit several times. They're just rebuilding from Hurricane Ian in 2022. And then, of course, just digging out after Hurricane Helene, which was only 2 weeks ago. And now they're doing the same following Hurricane Milton, which churned in the Gulf of Mexico and moved toward Florida this week. And the warnings from officials were certainly dire. Mayor, let us begin with you in the sense of, as you mentioned, your counterparts in Florida who are dealing with issues of trying to, well, right, it's you have to go over and see what you can find of life to find as many people, to help as many people there, and then assess the damage, and then start to get life back to normal.
Well, I think, you know, that one of the key factors is the preparation piece of it. And Mayor Castor is a friend of mine. I have traveled with her. She is very active in the U.S. Conference of Mayors, so I know her quite well. And as a former police chief, she certainly understands the challenges of first responders when dealing with a natural disaster. And there is a point of no return where even the first responders can't respond. And so I thought that she did a really effective job of messaging. I believe her direct quote was, if you do not evacuate from mandatory evacuation areas, you will die. And that is the type of messaging that I think sometimes leaders worry about panicking people, but given the death toll from, the previous hurricane, I think it was warranted, and I think she did a good job. And it looks as though, at least from the news reports, that most people chose to evacuate.
So let me ask you, I've thought about this a lot over the last 24 hours because I had a friend whose parents refused to evacuate. And I was curious by this because the thing they kept on saying is, oh, they keep on telling us, you know, you're going to die, you're going to die, you're going to die. And this is the fourth time we've heard that and nothing happened. And sure enough, they woke up yesterday morning and everything was fine. I agree with you entirely. I said this on the air 2 days ago, but I was ready to evacuate from Greenwich, New York. Like I'm out. I'm gone. But I don't know. But there is that. Cute Who Cried Wolf, and I'm just wondering how you deal with that as a public official.
I think there was a snowstorm, as I recall. I recall being with Governor Hochul and preemptively declaring a state of emergency because all of the forecasts indicated that it was going to be a pretty devastating storm. And it turned out that it was not as devastating in the city of Albany. But I would make that same decision again. We have to use the information that is available to us. And I see forecasting technology continuing to get better and better. It's not where it needs to be. But shame on us if we don't say, hey, the forecasters are telling us that there could be a 15-foot storm surge and this entire area could be wiped out. But, you know, you decide. Right. I think that is very challenging. And as leaders, we want to prevent death. We want to prevent as much harm to people as we can. It's the human life factor that comes first. And knowing that if there is a 15-foot storm surge, we can't get in there for a period of time to rescue people if they have a medical emergency or if they are injured by that impact. And so, you know, you do the best that you can with the information that you have. And yes, people will criticize and, you know, they'll say that you're claiming that the sky is falling. We're not. We're looking at the best data available to us. I was just at UAlbany where they unveiled their new supercomputer. And one of the areas that UAlbany is really known for is the Mesonet, and really looking at how do we get better at predicting what is going to happen in precise areas that are going to be impacted. We're not fully there yet, but I feel like with the technology that's available, we'll get closer and closer. But we have to use the information that's available to us at the time.
We came to a realization we were looking for information on the National Weather Service in Albany and realize that all of that is out of the SUNY Albany building. I mean, that's how important that facility is in the work they do.
Yeah. And yet, you know, we're kind of ridiculous. I was actually in Hamilton, New York, with the executive committee of the New York Conference of Mayors. And it was a half mile walk from our lovely little inn in Hamilton to where we were having dinner. And I'm looking at my app and there was going to be a break in the rain, according to my app. Right. It's going to rain for the next 3 minutes and then it will rain again. And so using that, we decided to walk, and it was a little bit wrong. It did rain on us a little bit. I mean, come on, that's ludicrous. You know, that I'm yelling at my phone saying, you said it wasn't going to rain. You know, so the technology has come very far. It's not there yet. But again, I don't criticize the actions of the mayors and those in first responders who really urged people to get out of the way of this storm.
March Gallagher.
This was a tremendous success story in terms of storm preparedness. I mean, you know, 80,000 people sheltered, people really listened, and the National Hurricane Center was dead on. I mean, I think the come ashore point was 20 miles off, but if you look at their predictions days and days out, they were calling exactly where it was going to go, and there was very little deviation here. And I think, you know, this, for all intents and purposes, was a tremendous success and a life-saving opportunity, and really everyone pulled in the same direction. There is a dog story coming out of this hurricane. You know, Florida state troopers on Route 75 near Tampa found a dog chained to a fence. I think that's a terrible thing, that people feel so desperate that they would actually leave an animal like that. And for me, this really calls out the long-term issues. We seem much better prepared to address hurricanes coming in from a coastal perspective. It's inland impacts that we were clearly not ready for. And I don't even know that you can get ready for the kind of damage that was suffered in Western North Carolina. So all in all, I see this, you know, the reaction to Milton as, you know, a success story. And that's a hard thing to say when you've lost at least 11 lives. But you know, many lives were saved here. Predictions were well in advance. And this speaks to not getting rid of things like the National Hurricane Center, right, which Project 2025 calls for. So we have to think carefully about those entities that are giving us real science and what happens with disinformation, because I saw a tremendous amount of rhetoric on social media saying that, you know, Democrats are causing the weather and actually doing weather modification. And that's insane. I mean, that's terrifying that this level of disinformation is being circulated. And I don't doubt that it could be coming from outside the country just to sow division. So there's a lot wrapped up here.
I want to get into that subject and also hear from Rich Honan. We're going to take a quick lockbox break. Got to get that through. And I really need to Oh, there's nobody in there? All right. Well, I got some time then.
How about a locks box? Can we do a locks box?
Yeah,
someday?
We've talked about that over time. Yes. Rich, go ahead.
I agree with everybody. The preparation and just like the local people on the ground, you know, kind of from the municipalities on up, just knowing what to do, working together, getting the word out. I also like the fact, at least in Florida, that, you know, officials have gotten a lot more aggressive or assertive about saying, hey, listen, if you don't leave by Thursday at 4, you know, that's up to you, but we're not coming to get you. I remember, and you didn't used to hear that 25 years ago, you know, and I like that. I like if people are going to make bad decisions, they're allowed to, but they're going to have to take responsibility for that. And you know, we're not going to send other people out, you know, to make up for that.
Let's go over to Pledge Central. We're going to hear from David and Sarah. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
And I was like, please stop.
Support for WAMC is coming from you, our listeners, at a rapid pace. But we can't make this challenge, Sarah DeDuke.
800-323-9262.
Without phone calls.
That's right, David Gustina. 1-800-323-9262 or online at WAMC.org. We do have a challenge on the table.
Come on.
We're interrupting the panel for just a few minutes, I promise. We'll go right back in, again, about 4 minutes. 800-323-9262. But we do have a challenge on the table. We're hoping to reach the $430,000 point in the lockbox by 10 a.m., which is 2.5 minutes from now, 1-800-323-9262. And between us and success in that challenge is $6,183. 1-800-323-9262. Over the last several weeks, we have been occasionally interrupting these special panels to ask you to help us fill the lockbox. But we have also been, as a sort of here's more we're doing for you so that you will hopefully be patient with us as we ask for these funds. We have been providing special panels with special guests on topics that listeners have told us are important to them leading into the election. We're asking this morning, what special panel topics that we've covered helped you most in preparing to vote? And what other key election topics would you like WAMC to cover either in news programming or on the round table? 800-323-9262, which I have more direct control over, and I will be keeping note of what you tell us you want to hear more about, and we will do everything we can to, you know, accommodate what our listeners are hoping to hear about leading up to this monumental election.
Sarah is taking names. 1-800-323-9262. 2 minutes and 53 seconds. Urgent, urgent, urgent now. We cannot make the $430,000 mark by 10 a.m. this morning without your support. It is crunch time, really, when we only have a few minutes to come to you. WAMC.org. Come on, everyone. This is about a radio station that's going to continue to do and perform in a way that no other station does, and that's providing you with verified, truthful information. We are credible. We are a community, and we must be all in this thing together. WAMC.org. 2 minutes to go.
2 minutes. We have half an hour left in the challenge. To make the challenge, $6,113 needs to come in from our very generous listeners and supporters. 800-323-9262. Key election topics covered thus far in roundtable specials include immigration, climate change, and plastics and recycling, LGBTQAI+ issues. We talked about Trump's finances and voting rights, economics, the state of journalism, tribalism in politics, Iran, the politics of chaos, and we had specials surrounding the presidential debate and the vice presidential debate. 800-323-9262 or
the never-ending panel.
1-800-323-9262 or online at WAMC.org. Thank you to Denise in Richmondville, New York, and Carol and Steve in Williamstown, Mass., who say public radio is so important for a healthy society, and we are so grateful. We have three new members on the sheet in front of me. Catherine in Bolton Landing, New York. Anonymous in Naples, Florida, who loves the station, listens every day, and says this is a great idea about the fundraising. and Diane in Middleburg, New York. 800-323-9262. We also heard from Kate in Mannheim, Pennsylvania, who says, Ray and Sarah are delightful. Thank you for your hard work, everyone. And we heard from Susan in Tivoli, New York.
Thank you. I'm David Gustina, sometimes misinterpreted as Ray Graff. 1-800-323-9262. He told me to say that, by the way.
I heard him.
WAMC.org. It's okay. We're here to make the argument, and you are here to say, yes, I agree. 1-800-323-9262. Turn that thought into action right now in the next 40 seconds, and we're going to get closer to that $430,000. We've got to get that $3,000 challenge from Saratoga Springs, New York, but not if you're not there with us. We can do this. We know we can do this. WAMC.org is how to do it, or 1-800-323-9262. Ms. DeDuke.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Again, a challenge on the table from Anonymous in Saratoga Springs. Standing between us and being able to accept the $3,000 from Anonymous is $6,013. So any part of that that you may be able to pledge now, please do. We have until 10 a.m. to make the challenge without going into extra innings. We're hoping not to have to extend. 800-323-9262. Time now to return you to the roundtable panel.
Thank
Please
you.
Keep pledging.
We'll go back to the Walkbox crew in just about 15 minutes or so and help them make the challenge. We need this desperately. We start the official drive on Monday, and the more we have in now, the less we have to do on the other side. So please help us. Help us get this $3,000 challenge. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. And thanks to Sarah and David or Ray, whoever that was in there. it was David. I'm just
more disinformation.
That's
happening.
Right. More disinformation, but it's the perfect segue to talking about that subject. I guess when we hear about this disinformation, and there seems to be, I think there are always scams. There's always things that happen after a disaster. Things are always afoot that shouldn't be. I am curious, though, this being an election year, March, and you can start us off on this, of what happens of how, especially when it is endorsed by one of the two candidates running for president, who is also, I say endorsed, but is at least spread by them of that gives it momentum just by that very fact.
There's been so much misinformation put out by the Trump campaign, by former President Trump himself. I urge listeners to Google FEMA myth fact, because there's a lot of rhetoric that FEMA was not on the ground, that FEMA had spent all their money on immigration issues. And in fact, it was Trump, by the way. Trump reallocated FEMA money during his administration to address immigration issues and border security. So he's projecting there. But it's made it very, very challenging. I think it's made it very challenging for people who work for the organizations that are trying to do rescue and recovery. And in addition, you have, you know, Republican officials, elected officials from these areas saying, please stop with the disinformation. It makes it very challenging to do the work. So it's being used in a way that is definitely not healthy and is not promoting the truth, which people desperately need when they're in emergency circumstances like this. And when you're in a situation where you've lost all your power and communications, you don't want people, the few minutes that they can get service, getting online and then being bombarded with this complete misinformation. So it's really a challenge.
Rich, what do you make of this narrative that is, as we see this in after Helene and now after Milton?
Yeah, I think narrative is the right term. I mean, it's a it's always the political season, and it's more so now. I don't think there's been especially more misinformation coming from either side on this storm than usual. I mean, the North Carolina. What happened in North Carolina, I think, first, I actually think it took people by surprise in terms of frankly, just how far away from the coast you could be and still get hit.
Be in
that,
the mountains. And
yeah.
Then, yeah.
Yeah. And so there it started with that. But, you know, look, there were real reports of people saying, you know, it's been 4, 5, 6 days and I haven't seen anybody from anywhere. You know, that doesn't mean that somebody was wrong, but that was those people's reports. And I think repeating that is not misinformation. If you want to then go and question FEMA, sure, go ahead. I mean, I think where people got into trouble was where, in my opinion, obviously, where the White House really jumped all over about, oh, we never said that FEMA gave, you know, any money to, you know, to immigrants. And then, you know, they cut to 2 years ago when they're saying, you know, part of FEMA's job is to provide for these illegal immigrants. This was in 22, I think.
But that's different of we're not able to take care of this area because that was done.
Well, but is it?
There were two separate allocations of funding. I mean, it was separately allocated funding.
No,
it wasn't taken from the emergency response funding. And I get it.
Well,
I mean,
is that true, though? Because what is FEMA? FEMA is supposed to be emergency response funding. And when the situation with the overflow of immigration came up, that fell within that bucket. Now, there are those, and I would agree, who say that's a very different analysis from taking care of, you know, natural disaster, you know, non-human made disasters, and you know, moving it over, taking money out of something that was based on, you know, political decisions. I think that's a fair thing to say, you know, to say that. I can't tell you that every dollar that was spent on, you know, resettling immigrants took away from you know, money that was spent in North Carolina. I don't think that's the case. But it's still an allocation of resources.
Mayor Shin?
Well, I agree with that. I think, though, back to the, you know, turning this into a political football, it's just disgusting. I mean, it used to be that when there was a natural disaster, we all talked about how can we help. And churches would send groups of people in to do recovery, and we would, as various municipalities would send resources if they were needed. And that is not the narrative that we hear at all. It's all about how do we use this tragedy to further divide people and separate them and get them to think about this from the perspective of my philosophy, my ideology, versus this is one country and we need to help each other. And I think it's just it has changed over my lifetime. This is not how we used to respond to storms. And I look at the efforts that I saw in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, when we took a mission trip there 6 months after the hurricane, and the folks from FEMA were still there. Still trying to help people. The folks on the ground working for FEMA saw a lot of the challenges and flaws in how the response to that was being managed, and had great insights and input. But notwithstanding the fact that some of those weren't listened to, they did their jobs every day. And so the fact that you have people who work for FEMA who have now been demonized, the very people that are there to try to help people are now viewed with suspicion because of this rhetoric. It not only hurts those who go in and do this incredible, brave work, but it hurts those who should be able to access the help that they're there to provide.
I don't think it's affected that at all. I think that yes, I agree. The rhetoric has certainly changed over the last however many years. But, you know, the idea of, you know, we always say this and it's a stereotype, but, you know, neighbor helping neighbor. I mean, that's all the stories you're hearing, more particularly out of North Carolina, just because it had been going on for a while. But you heard all those things, church groups and community groups and the local people being the first responders. I think that's still the case. I think that people are, it's a political season. People are going to take shots at the federal aspects of it. But I don't think that stopped somebody from getting aid. And I don't think that that made workers not be able to do what they wanted to do.
There are reports that there are those workers who are being treated abusively, that there is a lot of hostility, that there is distrust over the checks of, like, let's just get some money into people's right. hands right out of the gate. And the, you know, being told, oh, if you cash that check, that's all you're going to get. You know, this type of misinformation, it, first of all, people are under tremendous amounts of stress, and this just adds to that stress. And I'm talking about the national story isn't what you're talking about. The national story is about how do we tamp down the misinformation and the obfuscation that is happening. And so, you know, I haven't heard of church groups from Albany, for example, organizing to go down to North Carolina to help with aid. Maybe they are. I hope that they are.
No,
and
I meant locally within North Carolina.
But I'm talking about, you know, I remember groups from Albany going down to Texas when there were hurricanes down there. That was the story. And that may still be happening, but that's not what we're hearing about. And some of these areas are so isolated. You know, that's the challenge in North Carolina. I was just in Asheville last summer, and we, you know, jumped in a van and we wanted to see some of the more remote towns. And when you wash out those roads, I can believe that there were people who didn't see anyone for 3 or 4 days, because that's how difficult it is to get to some of these places. And I do think that better modeling, because we knew, you know, they knew that that soil was saturated because they had had a lot of rain in the 2 days before Helene. But to then have said, oh gosh, if they get another 10 inches of rain or 20 inches of rain, these hills are going to go.
Right.
We got to get better at that.
Some places got, you know, close to 40 inches of rain. I mean, during Hurricane Irene, we got, I think, 13 inches in the Catskills, and it was absolutely devastating. And we still have areas that are really not recovered from that. The FEMA misinformation, what we're really talking about is misinformation coming after the storm, right? That $750 is all you're going to get, which is not true, by the way. And I could have spent just days just going online to friends of mine and saying, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, over and over again. There's a lot of other aid that comes, and it's probably not going to be sufficient to rebuild. I mean, this is an issue that we're going to have to face as a country, which is we are seeing these tremendously damaging storms and weather-related incidents, and we don't have the resources overall to really bring people back to where they were from a family wealth position, right? You're probably not going to get back exactly what you lost, especially if it's a flood situation. You didn't have flood insurance. And we're going to have to rethink the insurance market, particularly in certain areas that are prone to these types of events. And in Asheville, you have a lot of people who came to that area thinking that that was a climate safe area.
Right.
So we
Very
really
much.
Have to think about what mm-hmm. it means to be a climate safe area. But when I was talking about disinformation, I was talking about pre-storm. I mean, I saw people actually believing that weather modification is what is being used to direct storms into certain areas to hamper the voting process. And that is a very, very unhealthy false narrative that could be coming from outside the country. This is what I'm trying to just educate people on, is that when you're sharing a meme on social media and you don't know where it's from, you have to be aware that it could be from people who just want to sow division in the United States. And that's hugely concerning.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that I had heard out of Florida was a person who said, all of this debris is still here from Helene. Now, again, 2 weeks between the landfalls of these two storms. And Biden is doing that purposely because he wants these to be projectiles that will kill people. You know, yeah. So first of all, the fact that you know, the president is responsible for debris pickup is a complete misunderstanding of how this works. But it's that type of misinformation that I think I'm talking about. It's constant and it's exhausting. And we were once better than that.
Yeah, we used to come together after a national disaster, and it doesn't feel that way right now.
Got about a minute. Go ahead.
I agree with what you say about the misinformation. I continue to think that people come together, and you know, think we also have things now that we didn't have 20 years ago. I don't know how all of us how many GoFundMe campaigns have you contributed to? You know, all of us have, right? You see a story in the paper about, you know, whatever, you know, a police officer, you know, who was shot or something like that. Lots, you know, we've all given money now to, you know, the Red Cross and to all the various things. So you do have that. I think that again, I think the misinformation is an overlay. I think it's always going to be there. I think obviously it's gotten terribly exacerbated by the fact that we start with social media and then it expands, you know, and you know, nobody knows, you know, what's true. And you're right. And there's lots of people with less than benign inclinations, you know, who are spreading those.
All right, let's go over to Lockbox Central and Pledge Central and find out, it's two centrals, to go out and find out how they're doing on the challenge, how they're doing on Top of the Hour. We'll throw it over to them, and then they'll throw it back to us in just a few minutes as we continue the conversation on a special roundtable this morning.
1-800-323-9262. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
I'm Ray Graff. No,
no.
Maybe I'm David Gustina.
Oh, don't trick.
We don't really
know. You guys,
know.
Truth and reporting. This is David Gustina.
Okay, fine. 800-323-9262. Don't worry. Ray Graff will be here later. 1-800-323-9262. How you can't tell the difference in our voices is a mystery to me.
It's okay. Now, I don't think you get confused that often.
Well, three minutes and 37 seconds left already. We haven't even started.
Right. 1-800-323-9262. We have a challenge on the table, a very generous challenge from Anonymous in Saratoga Springs, New York. And that's not to say that all the challenges aren't generous. Of course they are. This one does happen to be
$3,000. $3,000!
Anonymous from Saratoga Springs, New York will donate $3,000 to WAMC if we can now raise $4,784 before 10 a.m. 800-323-9262, WAMC.org. It's not going to be easy. We don't have a lot of time. But individually, for people who may call and pledge, it will be easy for you. It won't be easy for us to get this much money in this quickly, but if you call and pledge, that isn't a difficult challenge, task, I should say. It just takes a few minutes. Volunteers or staff are ready to talk to you, or the website's, you know, pretty user-friendly. If it's not your bag, give us a call. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
2 minutes and 44 seconds. Definitely not my bag, baby.
1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-9262. $4,784 in pledges. If that could come through rapidly here in the next about 13 minutes, then we get to accept this challenge. We get to succeed at our first challenge of this Friday morning, 800-323-9262. And most importantly, we get that much more money in the lockbox toward our total goal to shorten the full fund drive, which begins next Monday at 6 a.m. Next week, we will be, you know, taking over the programming day to remind you to pledge to WAMC from 6 a.m. onward till 7 p.m., 800-323-9262. And that, the duration of that drive will be shorter depending on how much we earn today. 800-323-9262. And of course, over the weekend at WAMC.org.
You speaking logic again, are you, Sarah?
One tries.
Well, you know what? Listen, I'm Ray Graff. David Gustina will be coming up after the 10 o'clock hour.
I can't believe
and how, I know you're waiting for him.
How much we sit here and say, you'll get the truth at WAMC, and then our very morning edition host comes in here and fibs to the people about who he is.
That's a
I'm outraged.
Trick. It's a little trick. It's a psychological trick so they'll know, because they know I'm not Ray Graff. 1-800-323-9262. How could I be? 1 minute and 19 seconds. Ray's nice. I'm not. 1-800-323-9262.
1-800-323-9262. You're both nice to me. 1-800-323-9262 or online at WAMC.org. 1-800-323-9262. A challenge on the table. We've made a little bit of motion in the ocean. $4,684 in the next just under 12 minutes, and we'll have made the challenge, and that will be stupendous to succeed. 800-323-9262. What a feeling. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Give us a call.
39 seconds.
Or go online, WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. A challenge on the table. We need to reach the $430,000 point in the drive in the next 11 minutes, and then we will be able to accept the $3,000 challenge from Anonymous in Saratoga Springs, New York. We're asking today, what have been some of the election topics that you enjoyed? What other topics would you like us to cover? We are, you know, we will collect your responses and take them to the programming committee. That's me, Joe, 800, and Madeline, 323-9262 or WAMC.org. Please keep calling. Please keep pledging online. Pretty please help us make this challenge. And now,
thank you.
Go back to the panel.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Thank you very much, David. And keep going, and we'll hopefully make that goal by the top of the hour. We'll head over back to the Walk Box just at the top of the hour and see how things are going. All right, let's move on and go to another topic, and that is the GOP Senate leads. This is something that came out yesterday, and I wanted to get to from the New York Times and Siena College's polling. The latest polling shows that Republicans are leading in key Senate races in Montana, Texas, and Florida. That creates the headline in the New York Times, Republicans appear poised to take control of the Senate, according to these new poll numbers. Control of the Senate appears likely to flip from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party this fall, as one of the nation's most endangered Democrats, Senator John Tester of Montana, trails his Republican challenge in his bid for re-election. Mr. Tester, who first won election to the Senate in 2006, is winning over moderate and independent voters and running far ahead of the Democrat at the top of the ticket, Vice President Kamala Harris. But as of now, that does not appear to be enough to survive in Montana, a conservative state where former President Donald Trump is ahead by 17 percentage points and where control of the Senate hangs in the balance. Tim Sheehy, a wealthy Republican businessman and a former Navy SEAL who has never held public office, leads Mr. Tester 52-44%, according to the poll. At least seven other Democratic-held Senate seats are competitive this fall, including the presidential battlegrounds of Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Wisconsin. In late September, a series of surveys in four of those races, as well as in Ohio, found Democrats ahead, though narrowly in some cases. The problem is that the Democratic Party has scarce opportunities to flip any Republican-held seats in 2024 to make up for any potential losses, such as in Montana. Mayor Sheehan.
Well, there you go. I think that this is going to be a close race all along the ticket.
Right.
So I think that voter turnout is going to be critically important. And I think it's very difficult when you get down to these Senate races where there is a much more local, hyper-local fixation on who people are going to vote for. They might vote for Harris at the top of the ticket, but the Republican for the Senate. And it is going to impact the Supreme Court. I mean, that's ultimately what hangs in the balance. If there is an opening on the Supreme Court and Harris does win the presidency, I think we will have 4 years of an inability to fill that Supreme Court vacancy unless it's somebody who shares the extreme far right views that that we've seen as that court has shifted.
Rich?
Oh, I was going to defer to March, but what I can't tell in these races is how much of this is, I'll call it local, how much of this is statewide and based on that particular candidate, mm-hmm. versus who's at the top of the ticket. I think this year it's harder than ever to tell. Do the presidential candidates have coattails? Do they have reverse coattails? You know, I don't know. You know, Trump certainly has proven that getting his endorsement isn't always the path to getting into office, right? I think Trump has taken some races that where a Republican would have won, and then Trump gets involved and, you know, picks and, you know, uses his influence to get an extreme candidate, and the Republicans end up losing. So I can't tell how much of this is a referendum on the national scene and how much of it is kind of issue by issue, person by person. The other thing I will say is, Mayor, you're right. It's all about turnout, which kind of makes me there's been a spate of stories about how the Democrats are starting to feel some trouble and we have to get people out. And, you know, when this becomes a headline in the New York Times, which some of us feel is really kind of just an arm of the Democratic Party, I think it's more of a clarion call to try and let's get out the vote before bad things happen. So I think this is a get out the vote effort by the Times.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, I looked around at some other polling and some other predictions, and, you know, Cook has a different perspective. 270 to win has a different perspective. They're kind of calling it a 51-49 in the Democrats' favor.
Yeah.
But, you know, Kamala Harris has a very big unfavorability rating in Montana of like 60%, which I think is really challenging to overcome. And I saw that $265 million is expected to be spent in Montana. I thought, wow, that's a huge number. And then I divided it by the population. I'm like, oh, it's only $241 a person. It's not really that much in terms of advertising in the Senate races. And then I thought it was also interesting that in a bunch of the other swing states, or, you know, states that will be challenging for the Democrats in the Senate, Texas, Florida, and Montana, Trump actually leads the Senate candidates in those states. So, you know, I think that, you know, it's hard for somebody like Kamala Harris to focus their energy on a Montana state when she knows that she's not going to win it for the presidential, yet she might lose that for the Senate. So, you know, how do you divide your resources and how do you focus on the things that matter most? But given some of these other prediction services, you know, maybe what you're saying is true, Rich, that the Times is calling something a little bit more dire than it might be from other sources. And it was interesting, you know, every time I see polling, I'm like, well, they're not polling millennials and Gen Z, and they're not polling cell phones. No, this was everyone, like the majority of people reached in that poll in the New York Times that they were talking about was on a cell phone. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. It was a Siena poll, right?
Yes, it was Siena, New York Times.
I think there it is, you know, the polling now, it's still fiendishly difficult. And I don't know that people even tell the truth anymore when they're talking to pollsters. But I do think that when you look at the impacts, for example, in North Carolina, to fill out an absentee ballot, it has to be notarized or have two witnesses.
Yeah, right.
Think about that. So that is going to really impact what's happening in North Carolina and the GOTV for both parties,
yeah, right.
Because you now have thousands and thousands of voters who their polling places no longer exist, right? And so, you know, looking in Florida, looking in some of these other states that have been impacted. And so it's the combination of voter turnout, voter suppression, and active voter suppression that is happening, you know, across the country, people getting misinformation. We went and knocked on doors in Pennsylvania. I went with a group of people outside of Scranton, and there was a woman who had received a message that said that she couldn't vote because she was an independent. So knocked on the door, asked her if she was voting in the presidential election, and she said, no, I'm not allowed to vote because I'm an independent. So having to educate her on now somebody sent her that message. Right. So this is the type of
somebody sent somebody that message.
Right.
Yeah. And who passed it on.
Right. Somebody posted something about it, whatever.
Right, exactly,
however,
right.
That the nexus of that, who knows? But that's the type of, I think, hard work that I'm hopeful that given the ground game that the Democrats have, and I know the Republicans have a ground game too, but that getting people to the poll, having them not be afraid that they're going to get challenged at the poll, and there are some states where people will walk in and there will be somebody standing there and saying they can't vote. These are the types of things that I think are hurting the fabric not only of our democracy but of our community, right? Where at least we felt like, okay, you know, we have an election and your guy won, my guy lost, but like we're still going to say hi to each other on the street and, you know, we might grab a cup of coffee together. It's not, but that fabric gets torn at every time we see these efforts to suppress the vote.
It's hard to think even though the Democratic Party as a whole would look at Montana and say, oh, we get a good shot at winning this.
Well, hasn't Tester been, he's kind of been in the I don't want to say the gun sights.
Crosshairs.
Yeah. It is Montana. Go ahead.
He's a pretty right-leaning Democrat. I mean, he's a very moderate Democrat.
Well you got to be right,
exactly.
There. But he's kind of been mentioned as kind of the shaky for you know for this upcoming cycle. But and then the other thing is, you know, the Democrats are going to take the House, right? So you know you're kind of back to where you are. You're still going to have. It sounds like you're probably going to have a split.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go over and check in on the lockbox, and we'll be back with our group. We'll finish up with our incredible panel, Rich Honan, March Gallagher, and the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan. All that and more after this Legal ID and a break over to Pledge Central.
1-800-323-9262. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
I'm David Gustina.
Oh, no.
No?
This is going to continue?
Oh, no, no. I'm not. I couldn't be. I'm Ray.
You're Ray Graff.
Right.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Our listeners are kicking tail.
They are
at
showing
this point.
Up. 1-800-323-9262. We have a challenge on the table to reach the $430,000 point in the drive. We were hoping to do it by 10 a.m. It is 10:01:50. And Anonymous from Saratoga Springs said, we'll give you an extension.
Okay.
Ray and I are going to come. The panel's going to end a little bit early today at 10:25. You and I are going to come back and pitch for almost an hour.
Okay.
We're hoping to make the challenge before we come back. So can we make this challenge by 10:25 a.m. now?
Yes, I think so.
$2,207 in the next 23 minutes. Maybe.
I think so. But
let's
we need everybody
it.
On a phone at 800-323-9262. We're filling the lockbox. The wall-to-wall, treetop-tall fun drive begins on Monday morning at 6 a.m. Call us now, and we'll shorten that drive. You've been magnificent.
We're so grateful.
We have already trimmed at least 3 days off this thing. Keep it rolling, folks. 800-323-9262.
Do you want to sing the little song you were singing before we came on air?
Which was it?
About not making the challenge.
We're not going to make it. No, we ain't going to make it. No, we're going to. Of course
but maybe
we're gonna,
we will. We didn't
we'll
buy
it.
10, so that was true before 10, because we didn't make the challenge before 10. But now we have till 10:25, so let's prove Ray's song wrong.
Exactly.
800-323-9262. Thanks for playing. 1-800-323-9262. Thank you to Constance of Feeding Hills, Massachusetts. Continue programs that discuss climate change effects and make them available to red state radio stations. We heard from a new member in Bennington, Vermont.
Ding.
They are Mr. and Mrs. Fred and Sue Booker. We heard from Rebecca in Austin, Texas. Hi, Rebecca.
Oh.
We heard from Anonymous in Troy, New York. Nancy in Selkirk, New York. I know, Rebecca. The Roundtable and Hudson River Sampler are Nancy's favorites. We would also like to see a program similar to Prairie Home Companion be added in that time slot. Thank you to Rochelle in Walden, New York. Says the opposite of a news desert, WAMC is an oasis and provides clear, refreshing news.
Thanks to Anonymous of Niskayuna, loves the hybrid form. David in Turner's Falls, Mass. You may have done these. Amy in Woodstock, who loves the station and listens every day. I love selected shorts of The Moth, saith Amy, and many other programs. Thanks to Deborah and Elliot in Niskayuna. Let me know if you've done these.
I'm not hearing.
Deborah and Elliot say, the good thing about the lockbox is that it shortens the fun drive. Correct.
Exactly.
The bad thing about the lockbox is there's no options for food pantries, shelters, etc. Well, hang in there. There's going to be things next week which may solve that issue.
Indeed.
Thanks to Wes and Doris in Mechanicville. Thanks to Jennifer in Albany, who is a ding.
New member.
Love listening to you, says Jennifer. Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks to Susan and Edmund in Lenox, Massachusetts. Our gift will come from a donor-advised fund.
Cool.
10-4, good buddy.
800-323-9262. $2,207 between us and the $430,000 point in the lockbox. Why is that important? If we can reach the 430. You turned me up in
no,
my ears and it startled me.
I changed the mix.
Oh.
This should have been in the middle.
Okay.
Now we can both hear each other.
That is good.
Oh, I like it. So it's only 5 days or 2 weeks or whatever in, but we've got it.
All right. 1-800-323-9262. A challenge on the table from Anonymous in Saratoga Springs. If we can reach $430,000 in the lockbox by 10:25, that's 20 minutes from now, and we need $2,207. Take any part of that you
yes,
can.
Please
help us make the challenge. Thank you to Lynn in Woodstock, New York, who says, I listen every day. The roundtable is great. We heard from Anonymous in Beacon and Pamela in Cairo, who I already saw that. And Kevin in Lee, Mass. There we go.
All right. And thanks to somebody who loves the station and really appreciates it, especially the roundtable. Thanks to Carol, and there's no name on the top, so it says AM. Thanks to Carol and Willow, who loves the panel. Thanks to, you did this one, Kevin and Lee.
Yeah.
We're getting some.
We got a little mixed up there, but we'll get back on track.
But we're not counting you twice. You're not
going
to get billed
no.
twice.
No, no, no.
You know, it's just the way we printed these out. It's
going
bad.
To be fine. It's not.
Yeah.
800-323-9262. 1-800-323-9262. These kind of little issues, incidental errors, I don't find worthy of dwelling upon.
All right.
800-323-9262 or WAMC.org.
Yeah.
$2,207 in the challenge. We have to go back now. We get to go back now to the roundtable panel, but please keep pledging WAMC.org. And Ray and I will be back with you shortly. Thank you, everybody.
We have to go back to the panel, and then we have to eat Brussels sprouts.
I like Brussels sprouts.
Exactly. Well, we hope
I make
like
really good Brussels sprouts. They're like French fries almost. They're so good. Nice and crispy.
Thanks very much to Sarah and Ray and the great work they're doing. Continue on, and we'll check in with them in just a few minutes. Mayor, I know you have to go and swear somebody in, right? So I go do all that mayor stuff. That's so cool. Before you go, let me ask you about the mayor, about the budget of this city and how that is looking. You have released it. What is the state now, and where do we go from here?
So we are in the process of the Common Council's review of that budget. They've been holding hearings on a regular basis. They bring in the various departments and ask them questions about the budget. The public has the opportunity to either watch that online or attend in person. There will be public hearings where the public will have the opportunity to opine on the budget. And I typically will get a request that typically is in the form of a budget memo that the council will send asking for certain changes to the budget, for us to take a look at certain areas of the budget. And historically, we've been able to work those out and get to a budget hopefully by the first or second week in November.
What's the vibe?
The vibe?
Yeah. Meaning,
well, look,
you
nobody,
set it out and then
yeah, look,
and nobody's like, yay, I got everything I wanted.
No, look, I think that we have funded the policies that the council has been asking for. We're continuing to invest in traffic calming, in pedestrian safety. We're continuing to invest in our parks, building the new Lincoln Park pool, our new community centers. We're continuing to invest in our street treatment program that we're doing with Albany County that is providing navigators out into the community where people are who are struggling. And we've made hundreds of connections, and they've been successful in connecting people with housing. And so this continues to fund that work. The one caveat for that is that if the council asked me to spend $1 million more on that, I couldn't, because we can't find the people to do the work. And so I would love to spend more money on it. And if there is an opportunity to do that, we will. But we're really struggling to find people. It's very, very challenging and difficult work. So I think nobody likes when taxes go up, but we didn't raise taxes for probably the first 5 years that I was mayor. And I think that that did put us at a little bit of a disadvantage. You know, with a 2% tax cap, you can't raise taxes by much anyway. But that it's really unrealistic. I mean, you think about your home budget and, you know, your ability to continue to balance your home budget without, you know, getting a raise or getting a second job, you know, finding additional revenue. So we did raise taxes within the cap. And, you know, that it's going to have various impacts, because we also did a revaluation. So actually our tax rate went down. But if the value of your property went up significantly, it's all going to kind of come out in the wash. We're saying that average homeowner isn't going to see much of an increase at all. Many will see a decrease, but there will be some who will be paying a few hundred dollars more, up to a few hundred dollars more in taxes next year.
And they might have been paying a lot more if it weren't for certain revenues. I was kind of surprised to see the school zone ticket, speeding ticket, technology is expected to bring in substantial revenues, like something like $4 million. And I was thinking, ooh, I wish we had that.
Well, I wish that it wasn't, because I wish that we were not seeing that speeding. I have to tell you that we have three camera zones now that are actually live for ticketing. It's no longer in the grace period phase. And the number of tickets that are being issued is astounding. And somewhere upwards of a significant percentage of those cars exceeding 40 miles an hour. We have one car going 61 miles an hour in the school zone.
We just went to 25 miles an hour in the city of Kingston.
Well, so yeah, we're switching to 25 miles an hour beginning January 1. So we want people to slow down. You know, this is really a critically important issue. And so what happened in New York City is that there was a big spike in revenue and then it fell off. No. And so, we still have to count it.
It's kind of like a one-time revenue,
right,
as people get get used to it.
So I would anticipate that next year, I would hope that we'll get compliance and that next year's budget, we'll see a shift in that.
Yeah. So that's a program where a win is decreasing revenue over time.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, people are cynical about that, but that is the reality. And it's what happened with our red light cameras. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've seen a significant amount of compliance, and that's the benefit of this. But, you know, I will say 2/3 of the vehicles that have been that will be issued tickets based on this week's activity are from registered outside the city of Albany. So, you know, if you're coming in and you're commuting, just chill. You know, listen to WAMC, turn on the radio, relax a little bit.
And I don't give myself away. So if you make all this money off of the speeding cameras, can you lay off the parking tickets? Okay.
Well,
I guess that's a no.
Still got to follow the rules, Joe.
I know. It's hard. Mayor, thank you very much for being with us. It's always a great thrill to have you on the program, and just makes us sound cool. And I thank you very, very much for being here, as always. Be well.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you very much. Mayor Kathy Sheehan from the city of Albany, and we thank her very much for being with us, and we continue the conversation. We've got about 10 minutes more before we throw it back to Pledge Central. See, Rich, you're the one that usually leaves first.
I know.
Mayor beat you. A couple of things I want to talk about that are we have letters here, so let me just go to those. As someone who works for FEMA, I can assure you that there are a number of different funding sources used for different purposes, all of which is used and can only be used in the manner prescribed by Congress. Reservists are paid from a different fund than Corps employees. Infrastructure repair comes from a different fund than individual assistance. The current problem with funding is because the current Congress did not make it part of their continuing resolution. All right. And then we go to this letter from Richard. INF is an account in the FEMA line items to be used by... Oh, we got some like FEMA.
Wow,
folks.
FEMA
experts
listening.
Like, wow. INF is an account in the FEMA line items to be used by eligible applicants, usually municipalities, to cover upfront expenses to provide immediate assistance to prevent death or preventable permanent damage from disasters. These funds have run out many times in the past, 9 times since 2006. It's likely the result of fiscal management and federal budget deadlines, not the result of funding immigrant temporary housing, a more recent development. That from Richard.
And the increase in the need for immigrant housing, that's not part of it either?
Are you arguing with me or the letter writer?
Just pointing it out.
Just pointing it out. That's right. Also,
I'd like to just point out that if we didn't have immigrants coming to the country, a lot less work would be happening, particularly in certain sectors. So I say, you know, let's keep drugs keep drugs out of the country, and let's let working immigrants in. Thank you.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, if the program was the way it's supposed to be, if the program was revolved around kind of the workplace, and I've heard experts here on this show, real immigration experts, who say, you know, that's kind of the answer. It is revolve the program around the workplace, have people do registration, you know, where it is that they plan to work. I absolutely agree with that. I just don't think that's what the program
would have been
used
nice
for.
To see that immigration package get through Congress. That's all I'm going to say.
Oh, that was an awful package.
Oh, I don't agree with you.
That was the, okay, we're only going to allow 5,000 new illegal immigrants a week. You want to talk disinformation and misinformation. Talk about the latest Harris statements on immigration, and apparently she was never in charge of the border, and that's kind of where a lot of these misinformation arguments start. But that bill was a terrible bill, and could have all been done by executive order without any legislative need.
Why were the Republicans that signed on to it?
Because I think there were some Republicans who thought that it represented, you know, movement in the right direction. But I don't think it was. And I think they were wrong.
So
listen, any negotiation about the budget, any negotiation about immigration where the lead negotiator for the administration is Mayorkas, you got to know that's not going to go anywhere. If I had walked into that negotiation and saw him sitting there, I would have told my people
to leave.
I mean,
I think, you know, the information out there was that the bill was ready to pass, but for, you know, former President Trump pulling the strings and saying, don't give the administration a win. So, you know, Mayorkas was negotiating something that was going to get through, but for Trump's actions.
No, it failed by it. There were.
Well, we know why it failed now,
yeah,
right?
But
this isn't after the fact, you know, sort of.
No, that was a bad bill, and it's better for the country that it didn't pass, you know, in my opinion, and in the opinion of the people who didn't vote for it.
All right, let's go to another letter. Had a call to the Fund Drive asking if you could share the exact URL for the FEMA myths and facts site that the mayor was talking about.
Said it.
So what it is, if you go to FEMA.gov, and then there's a search bar, and then just put in myth or fact, M-Y-T-H, myth or fact, then it will come right up. And it's a misinformation about FEMA disaster assistance can hinder recovery, released, 2 days ago, October 9th, 2024. But it is available on FEMA.gov. And just in the, I'm pretty sure if you just Google FEMA myth or fact,
yes, it'll pop right up.
I think that's what she was saying.
But if you go to the FEMA site, FEMA.gov, there is a search bar in there, and it'll bring you right to it. So hopefully that is helpful to you.
But Google it fast before Google gets broken up by the feds, which is their latest move.
And how do you feel about that?
He's not a Lena Khan fan, I take
no,
it.
No, listen, hey, if there's anybody who I think has monopoly power, it's hard to say it's not Google in the search industry. It's just the Department of Justice.
I'm
came
happy
out
to
yesterday.
See the Federal Trade Commission have actual teeth for the first time in decades. So
Bill says, regarding cell phone polling, it is my perception that millennials and Gen Zers don't answer their phones unless they know who's calling. If they're not answering, they're not being counted. Those generations lean toward Harris. Harris might be leading by more than we think. Well, I think it was up to you about halfway there, and then the extrapolation is...
When you drill down in that New York Times Siena poll, it go back to the, you know, how they did it. There, it is across the board age groups, unfortunately. I agreed with the listener before looking at sort of the detail on the polling. I was hoping that what the listener said was true, like, oh, they're not getting young people. And then I drilled down and I was like, oh, no, they do have some young people there. So, yeah.
All right. I think we can perhaps clear this up for the listener. Hi, panel. My son is a North Carolina resident who is currently visiting Arizona. I got North Carolina to send him an absentee ballot to Arizona. He completed the absentee ballot, and it will be mailed back to North Carolina. And then this is in bold, shouty caps. Did I just hear a panelist say that the absentee ballot was supposed to be notarized in order to be legitimate and counted?
You did.
Well, Mayor Sheehan's not here, and she's the one who said it. I don't know. I think you could probably clean up this question with looking at the North Carolina Board of Elections and see what they say on absentee ballots. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, it's always good just to check in, right, and figure out
I don't know. I will check that. I heard that said. I don't have any independent knowledge of it.
I'm going to make like a really wild statement here, and I'm sorry for making it, but you would think within the context of the form, if you were returning it,
it would say
it would tell you that you had to have it notarized. So, and if it didn't say that, then it would not be something you would have to do. I don't know if that's true or not, but we'll look. All right, let's go over to another, final story here. We've only got about 5 minutes left, and then we're going to head over to our Pledge Central and try to make some money for the lockbox before the drive officially begins on Monday. Donald Trump calls for making car loan interest tax deductible. The auto loan, this is from the Wall Street Journal, which I chose just to make Rich happy.
Thank you. It's the only story I'm able to actually access.
March was unable to. I had to send it to her in a doc.
That's good. We have good diversity
among us. But I love this topic.
Yeah. Donald Trump says he wants to make car loan interest payments tax deductible and took a warning shot at Chinese car companies looking to send Mexican-built vehicles to the U.S. in proposals aimed at strengthening the American auto industry. Trump outlined his plans, which also include renegotiating the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement to address his concerns about Chinese cars being made in Mexico. And at an event on Thursday before the Detroit Economic Club,
That's got to be a rocking bunch, right?
Which he took a shot at Detroit. I thought that was great.
I love that.
He said he would impose a 100% tariff or more on such vehicles exported to the U.S. What do you make of that?
You know, I used to like the idea of using the tax code to make policy. You know, best example, the deductibility of home mortgage interest. But so I get it, and I can see how it's good for the industry. It's just, man, we have a really big deficit, you know, and you'd have to demonstrate to me that somehow if you're going to cut revenue here, and I'm all about paying less taxes, but I like the idea. I think it would be good for the industry. I'd like to know what the other fiscal consequences of it would be. Because our deficit is really big and getting bigger every day.
I have a theory about this. I don't think it's going to have much impact at all, Rich, because under the Trump tax law, we reduced the number of people itemizing from 30% of taxpayers to 10%. So hardly anybody is itemizing their taxes, which means most people are not going to take this deduction. And I think we could look back pre-1986, you know, the 1986 tax reform. Prior to that, we actually did have this deduction in place. So, you know, we could probably get
interest.
A sense. Yeah.
All interest deductions.
So, you know, it was a different world. Credit card interest was deductible. Gosh, I wish that was true for people. But, you know, car debt interest was deductible. And one of the things that's happened over the last few years is that car loans have gotten bigger. Monthly payments have risen tremendously from like $470 a month in 2020 to over $600 a month in 2023. That's because car prices have gone up, you know, almost 30% in a period of time. Who is making those loans have changed. It's more, you know, less banks and more sort of independent origination organizations. So, you know, car loans are 25% of all consumer debt, which kind of makes sense outside of your mortgage, which kind of makes sense when you think about it. What is the largest thing you're buying for most people? It's a vehicle, right? They're not buying a boat. You know, they're not buying, you know, really expensive jewelry. This is one of the single largest purchases people make. But I don't think it'll have that much impact. I think it was said to make people in Detroit happy, but really is not going to have that much impact overall.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of these tax proposals that we're hearing from both sides, right? They're just kind of throwing something to
one of
voters.
The things that people
just about 20 seconds go ahead.
People were commenting is why is he insulting Detroit in Detroit? Look, Detroit business people know that their city is in crisis. It's not a surprise to them.
Yeah, but
still, they know they don't want to see other places take the suffering that Detroit.
Look, at
has
least
had.
He came in with allegedly an idea to help mitigate it, right? You're not sitting in Detroit saying, hey, everybody come move to Detroit because it's the garden spot of the United States.
I want to thank Rich Honan, March Gallagher, and Kathy Sheehan for being with us this morning. We're going to go over to Pledge Central, and we'll have another roundtable panel when the fund drive is over. When is that? Well, that's on you, and we can do it right now.